This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 91. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and use offer code IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. Today you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, amateurs and professionals. All of us are here to learn about photography and become the best that we can at the craft that we love. To talk about today's topics, I am joined by my friend Darren Meller.
Hey Jim, how are you doing on this lovely Friday?
I'm doing good. It's Halloween, and we're recording this a couple days in advance, but it's Halloween, so I'm excited to get out with the kids and play tonight. But until then, we're talking photography, and we have some big news to share with everybody, don't we?
We do. We have some great news to share that I think is going to really help the educational programs, and I'm really excited for you to digress and talk about it a little bit further.
Yeah, what we're doing is we are looking for ways that our audience can help young photographers who are just starting to learn photography in schools, in high school and middle schools across the United States and the world. So I talked to a photographer recently, a little 14-year-old girl, and she said she was taking a photography class, so I asked a little bit about it, and she said that the class was teaching them about aperture, ISO, and shutter and stuff, but the class didn't actually have any cameras for them to use at all, none. And a couple people in the class had digital cameras, just point and shoots, but they couldn't actually practice all of the things that they were working hard to learn. And I thought, man, that is such a shame. I think we could do a lot better for them. And Darren and I have been talking about what we could do. During the holidays, we all have a lot of ways that we can donate money to help other people. And we realize I'm sure we'd have people being willing to donate financially, but we've also found a different way that you can donate that actually may put some money back in your pocketbook. So one thing we realized is both of us have closets full of old photo gear. If you've been doing photography for a while, you definitely have, outgrown that kit lens that you're really never going to use again. Or you may have an old camera body that you updated to a full frame and it's just kind of collecting dust on the shelf and you think, someday I may use it, but you really don't. Or you bought the cheap Walmart tripod and eventually you bought another one that was a little bit better and then you finally bought a really nice tripod. And so you have these other two that really aren't being used. And so what we're asking the Improved Photography community to do is to be willing to give to these young students to learn photography by packing up that gear that you're not using right now and just sending it in to us. And from there, we're going to take care of everything. We're going to put it in packages that will make the gear useful for the school, so they don't have a lens for a camera that can't use it and the batteries all work, that it has everything that they need. Make sure they have transmitters for the right flashes, all that kind of stuff. And we're going to put together a nice package for the schools that we donate this to. And we're also donating thousands and thousands of dollars of training materials to these schools so that they can have what they need to teach the kids. So it's something we're really excited about, and I think it's a cool way that we can give, especially this holiday season.
Oh yeah, and you can definitely put money back in your pocket because a school is considered a charitable organization, and we'll work with the school, and when we have a finalized product of how we're going to do this, you can go to improvephotography.com/help and you can learn about how you could possibly write this off on your taxes. So you're giving and you're putting money back in your pocket. What else could you ask for?
That's right, and you keep money from going to Uncle Sam. Well, that kid doesn't get much better than that. So, your individual tax situation is going to differ. That's something you need to talk to your tax professional about. But what we're going to do is when you donate the gear, we're going to write a letter explaining, what it is that the project is. And we're also going to get a letter from the school, the nonprofit that the materials go to, and we'll provide you that information so that you can use as you prepare your taxes. And hopefully you'll be able to get a tax deduction for it. And most importantly, you'll be able to help out some young photographers who are just getting started. And, it can be a real shot of confidence for young people as they start to take on photography and learn some new things. So it's something we're excited about it. please go to improvephotography.com/help. Has all the information you need there. It's really easy. We'll take just about anything you got because I'm sure we can work it together in a package. There are a lot of schools that have just nothing to start with. And so we're gonna put that together for them.
Yeah, you just can't put a price on that hands-on value that they have back to actually using the instrument. When you were describing the students learning the principles of photography, I thought about a band musician learning how to play drums without drums. So I think this is going to be a great project, and I feel really happy about it.
Yeah, I think it's a cool thing that we can do. So don't let this podcast, you know, if you're working out, you're commuting or whatever, don't let this just go in one ear and out the other. Take just a second, and I bet you have a couple things that you could chuck in a box and send to us and that could go to some real good use this winter, and we're going to continue the project hopefully over time. So go to improvephotography.com/help for more information about that. But let's get to today's topic. We have tons more tips to talk about. Seems like the last few episodes, as soon as we end the recording, we go to our show notes page. We use a Google Doc to kind of communicate as we're recording, and we just are starting to fill out even more things that we forget. We're getting more behind every podcast we record, Darren.
Yeah, it seems that way. I mean, we learn more and we explain it, we talk about it, and then something else comes up the next day when we're shooting saying, oh, and I take out my little notepad app on my phone and I say, I need to write this down because this is quite important that I learned and it was kind of a mistake that I don't want to make again.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one thing that I found that was kind of cool is in two episodes ago, I mentioned the Click Sit. It's just this tiny little super lightweight seat that you can get, and it's just to help you, especially during landscape photography. You know, you often get there real early in the morning before sunrise, and you may have a good hour's wait waiting for the light, or you're doing a time lapse at night, things like that. And so I find that I get better photos if I'm just comfortable for that time and I can actually wait for the light. So Click Sit makes a great seat, very lightweight. I also found one on Amazon that's a lot less expensive that you may check out. So go to improvephotography.com/91. That's the show notes for this episode. And I'll have a link to that specific seat that I found. It's really the exact same thing. It's just less expensive. It is a little bit heavier, but it's less expensive. Still light enough and tiny enough. I mean, it folds really, really tiny. It's a small seat that you can just chuck it in your photo bag when you're going out to shoot landscapes. And it's been really nice.
And it still serves the purpose of resting your bones while you're waiting for that great shot.
Yeah, that's right. And it gets great reviews on Amazon as well.
Awesome.
Another thing that I wanted to talk about is I've been thinking about composition a lot lately. And especially earlier in the podcast, that was a year and a half ago now. Whatever time we are into the podcast, we talked about the 10,000 image challenge, and I don't know, well, originally the 10,000 number came from Malcolm Gladwell, but I think other photographers have talked about this. I'm not sure quite who to credit on the idea though. And so the idea is just spend every waking second of your day for a couple weeks looking at images all over the web. Look at Pixoto and Flickr and 500px or wherever you want to go. But spend every second you can, you know, during your lunch break, your break at work, you know, if you wake up and you read blogs on your phone, switch to just looking at some beautiful photography. If you watch a show or read a book as you're falling asleep, switch for just 2 weeks and just spend a lot of time looking at good photography. And the idea is when you get to that 10,000 image number, when you've looked at just 10,000 beautiful photos, it really starts to train your eye. And that's one of the things that's really solidified to me as I go around and I shoot with the Improved Photography Travel Group, is you can see the more experienced photographers not by the gear they shoot or not necessarily even the quality of their photos or even their technical knowledge. The best way that I can tell somebody who's really experienced in photography is as you're walking around, they see photos, they see ideas all around them. And so you see the newer photographers in the group who are kind of there just learning, and they kind of just, you know, they'll go to the postcard shots and they take there, and then they kind of look around at everybody else like, you know, what are you shooting? What are you finding to shoot? And these photographers that have spent a lot of time looking at great photography, you remember, oh, I saw this one photo where they had kind of a similar situation in nature and they used it, you know, as a foreground element or whatever. And it's incredible how much it opens up your creative mind by just spending some time looking at beautiful photos. And so since that was solidified to me lately, as I've shot with a lot of different ranges of photographer skill levels, that's something that I really want to encourage you to do over the next couple weeks.
I would encourage it as well, because if you're able to just picture the shot in your mind before you even take the shot, that's one thing I've noticed as well when shooting with groups of photographers, is that some of the less advanced ones will just shoot, and then the other ones will take a moment to, you know, process that information from those 10,000 photos they viewed and say, okay, well, this is the situation I'm in, this is what I've seen in the past, and this is how I'm going to put my artistic spin on it. I have to give a shout out to one of our students at photoclasses.com. He actually took a really awesome picture of his daughter sitting in a bowl of empty Cheerios and put a pitcher of milk in the box of Cheerios there with a spoon. And him and his wife just thought about it. They said that they maybe saw an ad down the road. Previously that led him to that. But just seeing that image and knowing that they had a cute daughter, a bowl of Cheerios, and all the ingredients to make a good shot, I think that solidifies what Jim's saying about seeing all those different photos and knowing what you can do, even within your home.
Yeah, absolutely. And an example of that is what probably my favorite photo of all time, maybe not my favorite, one of my very favorites, is one that I took in northern Idaho of a tree leaning over the water and these just beautiful sun rays coming through the clouds and just falling right on this one lone tree that's leaning over the water. And the only reason I even took that photo was because a couple years before, maybe 3 years before, I saw a photo on SmugMug of a leaning tree over a lake and beautiful light hitting it. Now, it was a completely different place. It was a completely different tree. It was a very different crop to the photo. I mean, this was not recreating the photo by any means. It wasn't even the same place. But just by seeing another photographer who had shot that leaning tree over the lake and saw that as a photo, and I loved that picture, when I was at another lake and I saw a leaning tree over the lake, I thought, aha, that's something that I can shoot, and you immediately jump on it and you can start taking the picture. So going out and seeing other people's photos will inspire you, especially with landscape. Sometimes we just think of this with portraiture, where you can get an idea for a specific pose or a specific lighting style. Sometimes it's just how you use nature in the frame that you're learning by doing this.
Oh, for sure. And also, when you were shooting waterfalls, did you seem to find when you were looking at them that you just did the wide open shot, or did you go in and start to pick it apart and feel, you know, the dynamic between each little part and to tell the story? Because when I do some waterfall shots or just do landscape shots in general, I always find myself, and it's just an old habit that's hard to break, to shoot as wide as possible. And I'm starting to find out that the nuances within the details are what really matters, and why waste those megapixels with a very wide shot if eventually we're just going to crop in and have, you know, this amazing photo that's only using a fraction of the megapixels our sensor has to offer us.
Yeah, that's a good example is waterfalls, because waterfalls, I rarely find, like maybe 5% of the time, do I find that the wide, you know, when you're way back far from the waterfall, you're shooting wide and you include the entire waterfall, I rarely find that that's the money shot. I mean, like 5% of the time. What I usually see is, you know, I'll get there, I'll shoot that one wide shot, and then I'll just go look for interesting parts of the waterfall and just include parts in the shot. And those photos are always much more successful by doing that. Once I started doing that, my waterfall photos started to get better. Waterfalls, you know, it's easy in the sense that you can just point a picture at it and snap it, and it's probably going to look beautiful because it's a beautiful place. But to get that really, really good waterfall shot is really tough, and I've really struggled with it. I think I may be starting to make some headway now, though. And one tip that's helped me is when you're shooting waterfalls, you usually, you know, you want to get in there tight, close to the water, so it feels more intimate, you know, not like you're zoomed in from a mile away. So one thing that's hurt me in the past is I would start shooting those big wide shots, which means you've got to, you know, turn your lens up. You point the ball head up a little bit so that you can get the tall waterfall. And when you point that lens up, your lens gets wet, like, you know, in seconds. It just doesn't take long, just from the spray in the air coming from the waterfall. So you get a couple shots and then your lens is wet, and then you try to get in the details, but once it's wet, it's just so hard to get it dry and all the water off and not have it start to fog up and stuff. So even if sometimes what I'll do is I'll put a UV filter on there and then I'll take it off halfway through so I can get a dry lens again. But what I'm starting to do now is I'm scooting in close and getting the small detail shots, because there my lens is pointed more even. I don't have to shoot up to the top of the waterfall, so I can get those photos without my lens getting wet. And then at the end of the shoot, I'll scoot back and get that one wide shot where I tilt the lens up and get the entire height of the waterfall and let the lens get wet at that point.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I've been shooting with the 16-35 f/2.8 lens, the version 2 that Canon has, and I've been shooting it for a couple weeks, and I'm starting to realize, as I kind of said earlier, that wider might not always be better, because was it Michael Fry on the show who was shooting with a 70-200 for his landscapes?
Yes.
Yes. When Michael Fry was on the show, it kind of threw me for a loop listening to that, because I was out in the middle of Arizona listening to the podcast as a fan. And I said, well, why wouldn't you want to have these wide shots? And now that we're learning about the necessity to have all these megapixels to fill like a new Apple 5K display, or just cropping an image in and realizing our camera only comes with a certain amount of megapixels on there, why would we want to always go wider? So as I started shooting the 16-35, I did have some learning experiences of using my legs to zoom in and out within the photo. But I actually, in the middle of the shoot, swapped my lens out. I put the 16-35 away and pulled out my 70-200 because it was low light and it was what I was looking for as far as the aperture speed and everything. And I found out that the tiny details actually told the story more, because when I was picturing those photos in my mind, I was picturing taking them back to Lightroom and cropping out 3/4 of the image. And why would I do that? I'm on my Canon system with the current cameras I shoot, I'm at 20.2 megapixels. And why would I want to be stuck with only a couple and have to start losing those very vivid details? So I think that's something that's also very important, is to look at your focal length. And, you know, for the most part, for depth of field, I have to say wide angle lenses are great for depth of field. But when it comes down to it, I love experimenting with telephoto lenses just to get that shot that I would have otherwise cropped out in post-production.
Yeah, that's a good point. And just to clarify, you're saying that you, not that you lose resolution when you zoom in, but when you crop in on your photo.
Yeah, when you crop in post-production in Lightroom or Photoshop, that's when you're going to lose those megapixels, because you're not capturing as much of the frame. You're only taking a part of that full 20.2 megapixel frame and actually having that as your usable image for printing, sharing, etc.
Yeah, that's a good point. Another thing that I saw as I was shooting that waterfall, something that's never happened to me before, but I was shooting on my backup camera that I talked about in the last podcast. And so I couldn't see the photos as I was taking it because the LCD is broken, because my primary camera was dead as well. But I got water inside my viewfinder. I've never had that problem before. But I saw that my image was really foggy and had water drops on it, and I thought, oh, great, my lens got wet. So I went and checked my lens, and it's bone dry. And I thought, huh. And so I checked the back of the lens and everything, looked through, and everything looked perfect. And I thought, what is going on? And then I realized it was somehow water had gotten inside the viewfinder. And so everything was foggy for the next, not just a couple minutes, and not just fog, but like there was actual water in the viewfinder, which was really, really strange. Well, we have lots more to talk about, but before we go on, we want to take just a second and thank two of our sponsors. Animoto is a sponsor of the Improved Photography Podcast. And we thank Animoto for their support of the podcast. They're a new sponsor. So I want to take just a second longer than we normally do to explain a little bit of what they do. Animoto makes awesome slideshows for your photos that you can give to clients. Now, there are a couple cool things about Animoto that really set it apart from other options. The first thing is, if you get their business account, which I would really recommend to you to go there, they'll give you a 1080p, you know, full HD video, But this is the cool part. They license the music from a certain retailer that has really good music. I mean, like, real music. You know, you usually go out and you buy, you know, a stock song or something to include in a podcast, a commercial production, and the songs are just terrible. It sounds awful. So some photographers make the terrible choice of using, you know, regular, you know, big songs, but they don't have the license to use that commercially. And so photographers can get in big trouble. Like, you wouldn't believe it trouble. But Animoto is cool because they're licensing really good music to use in your slideshows. And it's not just that, but it's not just a simple, you know, fade, picture. It's really well produced. They have some designers in-house that design their slideshow templates. So you can upload your photos to the service. It puts it in a beautiful slideshow, gives it nice music, and you're totally legal to give it to your clients. You can make unlimited slideshows. It's really, really a cool service.
And I've taken a look at it too, and you can also incorporate video clips as well. And it's just neat. Like, I thinking of it from a wedding standpoint, it's just kind of nice to have that photo of the bride and groom's reaction when they first see each other. But if you get that clip, that little video clip incorporated in it, you can also use Animoto to incorporate video clips. And it just has such a seamless look, and it's just so intentional when you put it together that it's beautiful. I think that I would possibly use it at a wedding and show people the ceremony during the reception. I think the shock and awe value of them seeing the photo saying, hey, that's me in that photo, I think that would really add a lot of value to your photography.
Yeah, I've done that before when I've shot weddings and different events. Is all, you know, shoot the photos at the actual ceremony, and then later at night you come to the reception, you upload your photos from Lightroom. There's even a plugin that Animoto makes for you that you can upload your photos. They go to Animoto, it gets really good music, gets their template, and bang, it's on there. And then you have a TV at the reception, and people, I mean, like, it was kind of sad at the wedding that I did this. Nobody was even by the bride and groom. Everybody was just glued to this TV because they're like, hey, that's me, I'm in that picture. Oh, that was fun. It was just so cool. And eventually the bride and groom just came over, and it was like the whole wedding party was just huddled around watching the slideshow. So it's a really cool thing to do. And if you're shooting professional photography, it's a really small price to pay considering what it is you're getting.
Oh, yeah, and you're getting a ton of value from it. I think that this is a new step in the right direction.
So if you want to get started with Animoto, they have a free plan so you can try it out and kind of see what they want. But when you're ready to get the premium plan that has the reseller license so you can, you know, use it commercially even on your paid shoots and stuff, then go to animoto.com/improve. They'll get you set up right there. And I think you're really going to like it. I've used Animoto for a long time, even before they were a sponsor. It's a great service.
It is. We'd also like to thank Squarespace for making the Improved Photography Podcast possible. It's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, you can visit squarespace.com and make sure to enter the offer code IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website. When it comes down to Squarespace, I don't know why I've been on the fence for so long to change. Maybe it's just been a busy schedule and whatnot, but I've looked at Jim's updated website and it just has a really nice flow to it. It's simple, it's easy, the design is beautiful and elegant, and it enables him, as you know, he travels around the world quite frequently, and I do too, to just drag and drop photos and update things on the go. And also they have a great support system to where you can email support and use live chat, because they're located both in New York City and Dublin, Ireland, and you can get support. So if you're in a pinch and need to upload photos right away, it makes it extremely easy and fast.
That is really nice to have that.
It is awesome.
Like, when you're trying to do work and your website won't work and it's 2:00 in the morning and you're just frustrated trying to get something done after a shoot or something, it's nice that you do have somebody to call to, but you know what? I've never needed their Squarespace support. It really is just easy to do it. I mean, even if you have no experience with technical stuff, you're going to be up and running in just a few minutes. It's a piece of cake to get started, and your website looks like totally professional.
It does. And if you'd like to start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today, just make sure to include the offer code IMPROVE to get 10% off your purchase. And we want to thank Squarespace for showing their support for the Improved Photography Podcast.
Well, another tip, since we were talking about waterfalls, and one other tip that I want to share with you is something that's really fun to do when you're dealing with a waterfall that has a little bit of a low flow. So sometimes you get to a waterfall and it's, you know, later in the season when there isn't as much water coming down. Or another situation that I use it often is you look at the creek coming down after the waterfall or the river, whatever it is. And often you get some really interesting patterns in the way that the water flows. There will be, you know, a couple rocks bunched up and the water will kind of swirl around in a little eddy, or you'll get it kind of zigzagging down a little path. And sometimes, you know, you want the waterfall in the shot, but you kind of want to make the creek your foreground element and just have the waterfall back there. And so one thing that I did several times when I was in West Virginia shooting waterfalls recently is I would start the exposure on a 10-second timer, and then I would just grab up a bunch of fall leaves and walk into the photo and just throw a big armful of leaves into the creek. And then I set my camera on, you know, a long shutter speed, 5 seconds, 8 seconds. And then as these beautiful yellow red leaves, you know, come down this river and go through this interesting zigzag pattern or circle around in an eddy, it makes just this cool streak of color coming through the water, and it just looks way, 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 way awesome. So that's a cool tip that you can do when you're shooting waterfalls and you want to add a little bit of interest to the landscape.
Yeah, and adding interest to the landscape's awesome, but one thing that I found out the hard way was a couple Saturdays ago, I realized that I was kind of paying a little bit too much attention to not only the scenery, but I was also paying a little bit too much attention to conversations with other photographers. So one thing that I wanted to mention is kind of a tip that might seem obvious to a lot of people is safety. It's often overlooked by photographers, you know, where we might be in a beautiful area, we might be in a really nerdy conversation with a fellow photographer and get caught up in the scene, and next thing you know it, you're on your feet, you've rolled down a hill, you've sprained an ankle. Luckily, I avoided an injury, but I was sitting there walking down this park in Omaha with another photographer. We were nerding out, and I rolled my ankle and ended up on my knees. So my body weight and my gear bag that weighed about 20, 30 pounds all ended up on my knees. And luckily I dodged a bullet, because I would have been down for 6 to 8 weeks with surgery and whatnot. But I just want to make sure that you're watching your footing and your steps, because as you're getting into those areas to possibly toss some leaves into streams, to add some dynamic to the photo and add to the story that you're trying to tell, make sure that you're being safe about it. That's a huge thing, because if you're going to get hurt, I would just hate for you to be down and out for 6 to 8 weeks recovering from one tiny mistake.
Yeah. So you told me when this happened, you said that you fell, you know, during a shoot, and I thought, okay, Darren fell, no big deal, right? And then I saw your photo on Facebook of you're like, maybe you should share it on the show notes. Like, you really, like, your body got destroyed from this. It mm-hmm. looks really horrible.
Yeah, essentially, I didn't wear those nice hiking boots, the Salomon ones that I recommended in a previous episode, and I was wearing just a low top pair of Asics running shoes. And I have weak ankles. I've rolled my ankles since I was a 6-year-old playing soccer, and I should have known that. You know, watching my step is something that I have been susceptible to falling before, and it was just this area where it transitioned from grass to kind of a rocky cement area, and next thing I knew, I just fell down and had both my knees hit the cement. And the photographer who was next to me, he was Air Force, and he said, "Are you okay? Are you fine?" And I had to walk away, because I thought I got to walk it off. I did the tough guy thing. I literally thought that, you know, I was going to have blood start to seep through my jeans, but luckily it was just a bunch of bruising. I went to my orthopedic doctor who did a surgery on my knee a couple years ago. He did an MRI, and we thought it was going to be a torn parts of my quad muscles were torn. And I thought, oh shoot, there goes China, there goes a bunch of other shoots that I have upcoming, and what am I going to do about this? But luckily the MRI results came back yesterday, and he said, just, you know, take it easy, still go hiking, still go on walks, still do photography, but in the same token, watch your step.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, that's a good reminder. I'm glad you weren't seriously injured. I'm glad the test results came back good. But there have been actually a number of photographers that have had serious injuries over the last couple of years, and some of them have died who were just kind of careless. You know, you're on the edge of a cliff and you're taking photos, and all of a sudden, you know, crazy things can happen when you're just not paying attention. It's kind of like texting and driving, but also photographers placing themselves in the way of danger. I'm sure you've all seen the photos that have become really popular over the last couple of years of people from India who are riding these bulls, these cows. They just kind of make a little leash between them, and they ride between these cows that pull them through a giant mud pit. And the photos are just super cool. It's called Paku Jawi. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But I looked at going to it. I was really interested in going. And then I looked at some news stories, and there have been photographers who have been killed photographing this event, because you got to stand in front of the cows to get, you know, the winner shot and then run out of the way. I was like, no, not for a photo. I don't think so. So you really have to use some common sense and think about things before you get out and you're shooting in dangerous situations.
Oh, for sure. And you won't be seeing me in Spain photographing the running of the bulls for the same reason.
Yeah, I don't think so. It's not worth it. Well, in this episode, we also want to share a doodad of the week. And this week, I want to talk a little bit about some of the mirrorless options that are out there. I published an episode recently on improved photography that, you know, it was a little bit controversial. Some people didn't like it, but I think it was important. I talked about what we've been talking about on the podcast for a while, comparing the iPhone 6 Plus to the Canon 5D Mark III. Now, I'm not even close to even suggesting that they're anywhere in the same ballpark when it comes to image quality. It's not. And there's no way I would switch to the iPhone for my photography, for serious photography anyway. But what I wanted to bring out was a lot of the technologies that have been made cheap by the cell phone industry that Canon and Nikon are just refusing to implement in cameras. Even on the most expensive $7,000 cameras, they just aren't adding those innovations that are now cheap. Let me give you a couple examples. One is the battery that comes with your Canon 5D Mark III or a D800 is between 1800 milliamps and 1900 milliamps. What's the battery in the iPhone 6 Plus? 2915 milliamps. That means your battery in your camera could last 40% longer if they would just use a different battery. Now, the battery could be replaceable. This is just the new battery technology can do this in our cameras. They just haven't updated it. They're just buying cheap parts still and not using the quality parts for a quality premium product. And lots of other things that I mentioned in there about the processors, the LCD screens on our cameras. So we're photographers, right? We care about image quality and exactly what our photos look like. And we need a good preview of what the photos look like when we take our pictures. Well, the resolution of the LCD screens that we're getting is like 5-year-old cell phone technology. I mean, we could have much bigger screens and like more than double the resolution we're getting in phone screens. Well, even a high-end cell phone costs $800. So why aren't we seeing those high-end LCD displays on our high-end cameras? And so that was kind of the point of the article. So I'd encourage you to go check it out on the website. Just go to the homepage and you'll see it right there. It's a little bit controversial, but at the same time, I think it's an important thing. And so if you're into technology, something to check out. But the camera that I want to talk about as my doodad of the week is the Fuji X-T1. Now, this is not a new camera. It came out in the spring. But I got to play with one this week, spend a little bit of time with it, and it's actually a pretty neat camera. What Fuji has done is they've taken the interface of the SLR and they've kind of changed it. Instead of going into the menu and holding down a button and scrolling to get a lot of things, they're giving you a nice way to control all of your aperture ISO and shutter right from a dial right on the camera. So on the lens, there's a ring that you can spin, and that's what changes your aperture. There's a dedicated, you know, dial that you can spin to change your ISO and your shutter speed. It's really cool. They're a lot smaller. The problems that I have with the Fuji X-T1 are, one is, it's too low megapixel count for me. 16 megapixels, that means you can't do any cropping at all if you want to have your photo fill just a computer monitor with the newer monitors that are out. And so that's definitely a negative for me. Also, the low light performance is not quite what you'd see in a comparably priced DSLR, as well as the focus system and the lens selection. There are limitations to this, and that's why I'm not purchasing one right now, but it was really fun to check out. It's a pretty innovative camera, and for a lot of you, it may be the right choice. You know, if you're not super picky about that perfect image quality, and you would rather have a camera that's fun to shoot, that's convenient and small and light and you could travel with, I'd really recommend the Fuji X-T1. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, it sounds pretty neat. That was actually the camera that I was toying around with possibly getting when diving into the mirrorless system, but it's just not quite there yet for me. I'm just waiting for possibly an update with some of those things like a higher megapixel count, but I held one in the store probably about 2-3 weeks ago, and I did love how you could adjust the aperture on the lens, and you could also adjust the ISO and everything else with actual physical buttons on the outside of the camera. It almost had a retro feel to it, but it still felt new and fresh, and I think it's going to be a solid camera with some minor revisions, and that's just what it comes down to. Like we've always said, that line on the paper of pros and cons of whether I'm going to buy it and whether I'm not, it's still leaning towards the cons, and it's just I'm right on the fence of that exact camera that you brought up.
Yeah, it's so close that I was like, please let me buy it. I wanted to buy it. It's fun to shoot. It's like driving a sports car. It's like, you know, it may not have all the power of, you know, of a diesel. It may not have some of the other things, but man, is it fun. It's agile. It's quick to shoot. So I really do like the camera a lot. For me, it's not quite a fit for the photography needs that I have. But for a lot of you, especially if you travel, you know, you're shooting your kids a lot, Fuji X-T1's pretty cool.
It is. And my dude out of the week, and I want to give some love out there to the PC users. Last week, I gave some love to Android users because Jim and I are both Apple fanboys, and I think there's no denying that. But there's this newer computer that's just got announced. It's the HP's new Sprout computer, and they claim that it could transform the way that you use computing as far as selling people products online for photographers, etc. It retails about $1,899, and what's really cool is it uses this technology that I've been actually harping Apple to use. Like for instance, Wacom, they make really nice tablets for graphic artists and for photographers to do some really nice precise editing inside Photoshop or Lightroom with brushes and whatnot. And they have a version that has an LCD screen on it that allows you to have that natural organic feel of drawing on paper like you would if you were sketching. So HP kind of, and I told Apple, I said, you could do this with an iPad. There's a Bluetooth chip inside the iPad. There's a Bluetooth chip inside the iMac. There's also wireless capability. We could do this if you wanted to just get past the software things. Either way, they still haven't gone down that road, but HP might have been listening. I don't know if they tap my phone calls or what, but this new computer is pretty darned awesome. It uses a 3D scanner. So for instance, if you take a picture of your baby against a plain background, you can actually use selections, cut the baby out, put it against a different background, and let's say one of your baby's blocks, you know, the ones with the little letters on them on each side, you can put one of those on this little projector screen that also serves as a scanner, and you can put that block into the photo. It's so amazing. It uses your fingertips kind of like the trackpad does on the iMacs and the MacBook Pros, and it's such a neat device. I mean, I looked at some videos and some uses on it, and for photography, for compositing, for just taking photography to a whole new level and how you adjust your workflow. Honestly, this machine really has me scared being such a huge Apple fanboy, because unless they incorporate something similar to this with on the Apple side of things, this thing is really going to make some waves. And I'll make sure to go ahead and include a link to this that I found on the internet in the show notes.
That's pretty cool. And what kind of level of computer is this? Is this a high-end thing, or is this, where is it?
It's a high-end computer as far as specs go, as far as, you know, it's computing power, it's processing power. The only thing that I find a drawback is it has a lower resolution display that I'm not really fond of. Its display, I think, was 1080 along the long side and 1900 on the other side, and it's not up there, especially looking at just my last year's model of the iMac being over 2,000 pixels on the long side. But as far as what's under the hood beyond the display, it is a pretty powerful computer because it has a scanner and a projector in one, and then that takes dedicated processing power, and then there's no lag in between scanning in something into your photo that might be 3D and transforming it to 2D. It also might be similar to when we see screenshots of certain things, and then when it comes out to the reality of what it looks like, it's completely different. But this does look like it has a lot of promise.
That's pretty cool. And speaking of resolution, and that annoys me that it's only 1080p, especially for such a media device. I played with the 5K iMac this week. I spent a little bit of time with it and looked at some high resolution photos on it to kind of get a feel for what it can offer. And this is what I'm going to say. If you're a nerd and you just, you know, you geek out about this stuff, you've looked at a lot of displays, you're going to get the 5K display and you're going to love it. It's going to be awesome. The detail that it's in there is incredible. Text looks just so sharp. Everything looks great. You're not a nerd. You like technology. You like things to be nice, but you're not like super picky about the image quality of your screen and stuff. Just buy the older version of the iMac. That's a lot less money. It's really neat. I love it. I want one of those 5K displays, but I can see how most people, like my wife, you know, looking at both displays, she couldn't tell them apart. If you took the label off 5K one, she couldn't tell which is which. Unless you're really looking for it. Most people would just say, oh, it's an iMac. They're the same computer. So anyway, that's kind of what I want to say. It's a really cool computer. I want one. But if you're not that guy, save your money.
Oh, for sure. And honestly, I'm happy with my equivalent of a 2K display. It's double 1080p. It's fine. There's still certain instances, like we've talked about in the past, where I'll watch a 1080p video on this screen and have to move it up to the 1080p screen upstairs because it starts to pixelate out. And that's just kind of what Jim and I were getting at, is that as these screens get better resolution, we need to have higher quality video and higher quality megapixel photos to start to fill these screens and still look good.
Yeah, like if you take a photo with your iPhone that's 8 megapixels and put it on that 5K display, it's a thumbnail. It's just puny on there. And so resolution in cameras has become very important all of a sudden. You know, people for years have been saying it's not important. Suddenly, it's pretty relevant. Relevant. Well, we can't mess up too many more words today. So thank you for joining us in this episode of the podcast. And we'll see you in a few days.
All right, see you soon.